You wait till after.
Oh, it's too early to cry. No. Oh, you messed me up. I'm messed up. My name's Janine. I'm an addict.
Hey, Janine.
Oh, how is it the person that can make me the most nuts on the planet also brings me the most joy? And I love you. I guess I'm supposed to sit down. I don't know if anybody can hear me. I've got the kind of voice that does not travel. It's just at the right pitch where he cannot hear me. It's true. 85% of our arguments are because of that. He'll say, but you said this. And I'm like, no, I did not. Let's see. I guess I should start off by saying I appreciate being asked to tell my story. It's a huge honor. It came as a bit of a shock. And when I was asked, my first response was, you want me to do what? And then I said, no, because I'm not a great speaker. And then there was this long silence, and then Maud said, well, it's your choice. And you know how when somebody tells you that, it really fucks it all up. So then I said, okay, maybe I'll call you back. And then I took a poll, and a lot of people said, well, I can understand why you wouldn't want to do that. People that know me really well know I'm not really very extroverted. I freak out telling my story in front of 10 people. And so I tried to go with that. And then there was this little voice in my head that said, you know, when you say no, Janine, and you don't give yourself a chance, and you listen to that part of you that is coming from fear and self-centeredness, that's okay, and I can make that choice, but it also gives it a little more ground. And something about having a kid this last year has really changed for me. I really don't... a lot of things that were an option before she got here are no longer an option. Things that, you know, your inventory changes every year that you stay clean. And things that were on my sixth and seventh step that I was okay with, I'm not okay with anymore. You know, I mean, how am I going to raise her if I don't make some changes? And part of becoming a mother for me is trying to just act as if a little bit more and trying to have a little bit more courage to show up, because I want that for her so much. And so I'm up here, and I'm like, what the hell am I doing up here? And I guess why I'm up here is because the five people that went up to the podium last night brought tears to my eyes, and it happens at every convention, and that's my favorite moment. And that's why I'm up here, you know, because for me it's just an opportunity to be of service and show the fellowship how much I love you guys and how much you have given me. And I have so much to be grateful for, that for me to not come up here and give it a shot would just be, it would not be good. So here I am, and I can't picture you guys sitting there naked. That doesn't work for me. I have a really good imagination, so I get real distracted by that. And there's just, you know, it's just not good for me to sit here and go there. And then I end up picturing myself naked, and then I get wigged out of my mind. So I'm not going to do that. I guess I should start off by saying I hope I can grow up and get clean in time. I grew up, I was born in 63, right? So when I was a kid, the term love child was used, and that's what I was. I was a love child. And it took me a long time to figure out that when people called me that, they weren't necessarily saying it like it was a good thing. My grandmother helped raise me. I mean, she kept me first I think 2 years, and then I went and stayed with them for summers. And my mom, she had hooked up with this guy that already had 6 kids and a family and didn't tell her. And so when she found out, she was like getting ready to give birth to me. And, you know, that was the way it was. And back then it was a real shameful thing for a woman to be single and a parent. So she did the best she could, and she let my grandmother take care of me. And she was in a real fragile space. And so a couple years later, she hooks up and gets married to this man who adopts me and changes my last name. And the problem was that I had bright red hair like my biological father, and I always knew what my last name was. I always knew I had this Irish last name. Well, when they changed my name, it was like a big shameful thing, you know, don't talk about it. You know, my mom would say, your name is this now, and, you know, I mean, it was just, we weren't supposed to talk about it. So then they had a child, so I had a half-brother, and I just didn't feel a part of, you know. A lot of the time I really felt, I mean, I stood out. They all could tan. I go out for 10 minutes, and I, you know, I'm a piece of Krispy Kreme. I mean, I just, you know, I just didn't feel a part of. I mean, my stepdad or whatever he was tried to love me the best he knew how, but I wasn't his kid. So our family was moderately dysfunctional, and as I got older, you know, I found comfort in drugs and alcohol. And my mom is like the most opposite of one of us of anybody you will ever find, so she really didn't have a clue. And my dad, he was kind of attracted to me, and I had stopped feeling safe at home, and I felt scared to come home from school. And he knew what alcoholism was because his dad was an alcoholic, and so, you know, he would kind of shame me a lot about my drinking, and then after a while he kind of gave up. And, you know, but I just wanted to be out of the house as much as possible and blot out those feelings, because I just felt so ashamed. You know, if you're attracted to me, you're supposed to be my dad, then I must be bad, you know, shame being I am bad as opposed to guilt being I did a bad thing. And so that's how it started. You know, I was 15, and I knew from the start that there was something different about me, but I didn't know what it was. The first time I got high, I freaked out and gave a guy a black eye. And, you know, I mean, I was just always that person that was just wild. And I was just kind of like really nice and sweet and quiet. And then the minute I'd be using, I'd just turn into a complete lunatic, you know. And for a long time in active addiction, I could kind of be that sweet young thing, you know, and I must have had some sign on me that said, you know, I'm a drug addict, and if you are a dealer, then please come over here. I mean, people would, you know, come out of the woodwork to throw stuff at me, and so my drug of choice was whatever you had. And I'm real grateful that there were a couple of drugs. One of them just wasn't around where I was when I was using, and that's the only reason I never used it, I'm sure. And then the other one, I tried to search it out at the end because I had given up on trying to stay clean, and this guy that I thought was just a complete drug addict said, I'm not taking you because I can try this and do it one time and you'll never come back. And we had a big fight over it, and to this day I'm really grateful. I'm really grateful because right after that I found the rooms, and you know, the rest is history. But anyway, I went to college, and my story is kind of peppered with sexual abuse. The thing about using, if you're a man or a woman, but probably for me, I would say more so if you're a woman, just because I am one and that was my experience. But, you know, being loaded has a way of putting you in the wrong place at the wrong time. And when I was 18, I was still carrying a lot of shame about my sexuality and real not okay with it because of stuff I'd experienced at home. And I went to a New Year's Eve party, and you know how it is, everybody's partying, and I got left there probably because I was extremely loaded and abusive, and it took me a while to get that. But anyway, a couple of guys, you know, kind of had their way with me and dumped me in my front lawn at my parents' house, and I was covered head to toe with vomit. And I think that was the first time that they kind of started to get a clue that something was, you know, something's different with our daughter. Something's going on with her. And, but they didn't know what to do. And no one suggested treatment, because where I was back then, I didn't know anybody that ever, I'd never even heard of treatment. And I really never would have thought of myself as a drug addict, because I didn't shoot dope. You know? And I really didn't think I had a problem, I just thought I was different. So I woke up the next morning and I told myself, that never happened. That never happened. That never happened. And pretty soon I was believing it, you know? And it wasn't until I'd been clean for a while that I was like, holy shit, that happened. You know, you do a couple of four steps and you dig deep enough and it's not going anywhere, you know? The stuff is in there, whether we want to deal with it or not. And the way I dealt with it was to start binging and purging, and I didn't know what bulimia was. I'd never heard of anorexia. I just thought, I'm a freak. I'm the only person on the planet that does this. And I couldn't stop. And it was just obsession and compulsion. And to me, that was just my disease finding a way to express itself. So I went through college doing that. And to make a long story a little shorter, I pretty much crashed and burned. And things got really bad, and I was suicidal, and there was always somebody there to, I mean, it was weird. There were times when, you know, somebody would just, like, look at me and go, you're not getting in that car, and wrestle me to the ground, you know, and I didn't say, I'm going to go and kill myself. They just knew. And then there were a couple of times when I tried, and I didn't succeed, obviously, because I'm here. But, you know, but I just stopped little by little. I tried moving to different town. I tried doing a couple of geographic cures, which never worked. I tried substituting. As long as I stay off of this one drug, I'll be all right. And I didn't know that any other drug I was doing was going to take me to the exact same place. And I tried a lot of different things. I tried exercise, the endorphin thing, and that kind of worked for a brief period, and then it stopped working, and I met this guy, and at that point I was like, well, I'm just hopeless. I mean, my entire life I had felt like I'm a mistake, I shouldn't have been born, I'm just not like other people, there's nowhere for me to fit in, I don't know how to live, I'm never going to know how to live, and I can't seem to succeed in killing myself. And so I met this guy, and I looked at him, and he was trouble. And I was like, wow, that's for me. So I hooked up with him, and before too long, I knew that he was going to kill me, and that was fine, because I had just given up on any hope. There was just no hope. And there was a lot of physical abuse and sexual abuse and emotional abuse, and I was okay with that, because I really felt at that point that, you know, this is just what I deserve. I'm a piece of shit, and, you know, I'm never going to see 30, and this is just the way it's going to be. And then one day, he was walking down this snowy drive, and I had tried to get out of the relationship at one point, but he chased me down and dragged me by my hair and got me back, and, you know, and I just, at that point, I surrendered. And, he was walking down the road, and I knew something was wrong. I could tell by the look on his face, and I had a flash, and I knew that my half-brother, whom my parents had put a lot of responsibility on me to take care of him, and I had saved his life a couple of times as a kid. Like, he'd jump on the bed and fall out the window, you know, and I'd be there and pull him in, and we were always real close in an unhealthy way. I mean, like, there's a kind of bond that forms when you're in a lot of fear as a child with another child, you know, because it's like, here's the one person on the planet that was there as a kid and knows what that felt like. I mean, I remember him being locked in the bedroom with my dad and hearing him scream and shriek, and, you know, I could hear him running all over the room and I felt like a bird in a cage. I was flittering around, and I wanted to go in there and get him out, and my mom had kind of dissociated, and she was ironing, and there was this blank, you know, she just wasn't even aware of what was going on, so there was just that kind of bond between us. I mean, I loved him, and I hated him. I was so jealous of him, and I resented him, and, you know, but I loved him, too, and no one else could beat up on him. It was my job, and if anybody else tried to beat up on him, then I would beat them up, you know, and so I guess in our dysfunctional family, you know, I showed him love the best I could, so what had happened was, while I was in and out of, you know, just doing what we do, he had reached out to me a couple of times, and you know, he'd call from a phone booth, I'm loaded, I don't know where my car is, and I'd just be like, well, deal with it, you know? I mean, at that point, I really didn't have any feelings, you know? I just, what was yours was mine, and what was mine was mine, you know? And anything that doesn't have to do with me getting more, you know, you can go fuck yourself. I really don't give a damn. And that's just how I was. So he had reached out to me a couple of times, and I was just like, I was just kind of a different person. You know, I'm not the person today that I was when I came in these rooms, but the person that I was just a real hard ass, and I just didn't give a shit. So anyway, this guy, he's walking down the drive, and there's snow everywhere, and I just looked at him, and I knew what had happened. And I just took my finger and I held it to my temple and I just said, my brother. And he said, yes. And it was bad. It was real bad because he partied just like I did. And for years in recovery, I just beat the shit out of myself because I felt like, God, you know, if anybody could have figured out what the hell was going on with him, I should have been able to. And today, today I know that, you know, if I could have helped him, I certainly would have. And I couldn't even help myself. But at the time, you know, I really felt a lot of shit. I hadn't felt anything in a long time. And when that happened, it was just like there was these 12-foot concrete walls all around me, and they just shattered. They just shattered. And it was like, oh, my God. I could feel this invisible hand erasing the script of my life. You know, I was pissed too because he beat me to it. I mean, we were suicidal at the same time, and I saw what it did to my parents. And, my dad went off to a mental institution. He completely lost his shit. My mom lost her shit. She was driving around with a gun in her purse, and, you know, I thought she was going to, because it happened on her birthday. My parents were divorced at this point, and my dad had moved in with him, and he was in the other room when it happened, and I mean, it was just bad. It was just really bad. And I felt like the script of my life had changed. I felt like all of a sudden it's no longer an option for me to kill myself, and I just could see it. I could see how substituting different drugs, the food issues, I mean, I could see how it was just all tied together, and I didn't quite get it, but I knew there was a connection, and I knew that it was no longer okay for me to keep choosing to do that. And and there's nothing like hugging a dead body to wake your ass up. I mean, there's just nothing like it. You know, I mean, I can't tell you what that experience was like, but it woke me up. And of course, it took a while. I mean, it wasn't like, oh, I'm saved. You know, it doesn't work like that, but for me anyway. So anyway, I went back to this crazy relationship, and I realized it was no longer an option for this guy to kill me, that I could not put my parents through another funeral. And I got out of it literally running for my life into the shelter office downtown in the town where I was living, and they locked me in a vault because it was an old bank building, and this 900,000 pound woman marched out there, and the guy was not stupid, you know, so he backed off, and they snuck me to a shelter, and then they snuck me out of town, and then I got on a plane, and I went to another state to hide, because this guy was a complete psycho, and I'd been through enough shit with him to know that I really just needed to get the hell as far away as possible. So that's what I did, and so within like a month or 2 months, 6 week period, my brother committed suicide. I found out I was pregnant, and I knew that I couldn't carry the baby. I mean, I knew that I couldn't, because I couldn't stop using, and I wanted to then. I finally, you know, was like, I really, really don't want to do this anymore, and I couldn't stop. And I knew that I still wanted to kill myself, even though I couldn't accept that as an out. I still wanted to, because I had no fucking idea how to live, you know? So I had an abortion. And that was really hard. But to be honest with you, at the time, it felt like And I still think this is going to probably piss some people off, but for me, it was one of the most spiritual things I've ever done, because I honestly could not have lived to carry that child. I mean, there's just no doubt in my mind. And I have grieved over that. And it took a lot of step work for me to kind of make peace with that choice. And I had dreams where this woman brought me this little girl, and she was that child, and she told me she forgave me and that she was fine with the choice I made. And I'm okay with it, pretty much. Although some shit did come up while I was trying to get pregnant. I felt like, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to get pregnant because I made that choice, and that's going to be God's way of punishing me. You know, because whenever I'm not getting something I want, I go right back into God's punishing me, you know, and I'll probably do that till the day I die. But my higher power is big enough to take it. So, you know, it forgives me. So anyway, I moved back to the state and left my uncle that I was staying with because I didn't want to trash that relationship. And I knew where I was going because I was just starting in that cycle again. And so for the next year, I told myself that I wanted to stay clean. And I figured, okay, I'm not doing this other drug and I'm not doing these other drugs. And as long as I just drink, smoke a little dope, I'll be all right. And I used to say, oh, the alcohol was the worst of all the drugs I used, but it didn't occur to me that it was really the progression of the disease, and anything I used would have been like that, because it's not about the substance, it's about the spiritual void that we have inside of us, and I mean, the unmanageability is going to increase regardless of what we use, but at the time I didn't know that. So I'm hanging out, and I move out of my mom's house because I go out, and of course, you know, the first person I hook up with is a dealer, and that was the criteria for me for relationships back then, was, you know, if you have a lot of dope, then we'll hook up. And of course, they got sex out of it, and you know, that's what I did. I traded drugs for sex, and I told myself, well, it's not like I'm prostituting myself, but of course it was exactly that. And but I picked somebody shorter than me because I wasn't going to be abused again. And what happened was I went from being the victim, and I had done a lot of victimizing in my active addiction up to that point. I had tried to run over a guy before with my car, and I had been in, you know, some kind of fights, and people had told me that I was real mean when I use and stuff like that, but it was nothing like where it took me. I mean, I just, you know, fighting and rolling around the barroom floor, and oh my God, I mean, I was just a lunatic, and I was just, that last rape just pushed me over the edge, and I just was a real abusive person, and I didn't care about anybody or anything, and I couldn't stay clean, and I remember just abusing this poor guy, and I remember chasing him down the street with a broken bottle, and I mean, that was the good thing about alcohol, is that you can't run, I couldn't run that fast, you know, and a blind drunk, so luckily, as far as I know, I never caught anybody and slashed them to bits, and I'm really grateful for that. And at this point, you know, people were starting to look at me, not as a sweet young thing, they were starting to look at me with pity. And that was just really galling to me. And I had freaked out and shaved my head, and that's when my husband saw me on the street that he was hanging out on. And I was not a skinhead. He keeps saying that. It's not, I don't know. There were some skinheads down on that street, and I did not shave my head to fit in with them. I shaved my head because I was so scared of men at that point and so terrified of getting raped again that I just was like, you know, fuck femininity. And I wore combat boots and, you know, whatever clothes were left over after the party. And, you know, if it was a Sid Vicious t-shirt covered with vomit, I'd wear it and walk down the street proudly, and people would cross to the other side of the street. You know, and I was just really violent. And it got to where people would be like, hey, we're having a party, but don't tell Janine. And then the people that I was living with, I wasn't employable, and I wasn't working, and I was just using every day and every night and every day and every night. And they were like, you know, you really need to start coming with us. Where they were involved in the theft ring, and it was like, you need to come with us because you have to earn your keep. You know, you're just, I mean, I was no longer the life of the party. And so I went and I realized the jails, institutions, and death thing was really starting to click with me. And I was like, you know, I feel like deep in my heart that I am supposed to figure out how to live, and I'm not good at this stealing thing. I'm going to get caught. And that's when I finally moved out of the drug house. And I mean, I don't know. That's a God thing. I moved out. I got a job, and I don't know why these people hired me. It was working with mentally handicapped adults. Maybe they were just desperate for people to work there. I don't know. But I know I did the chameleon thing. You know, I knew how to clean myself up and show up, and I'm leaving out a bunch of stuff for the sake of time. But anyway, I got a job, and I moved out of the drug house, and this guy just kept coming back, you know. And if somebody had drugs and handed them to me, I would do them. And I was drinking every day by myself, and you know, I'd have these binges, and I'd have to take 3 days off of work because I'd reek for 3 days, and it was just hell. And I really just wanted to die the entire time. I just wanted to fucking die. And I was so pissed at my brother. I mean, I would just be like, God, you asshole. You know, I'd grieve for him, and I'd miss him, and then I'd go right into being really pissed off at him. And so anyway, I know you guys have all been there, and you know the feelings that I'm talking about. And so what happened was, I was living in this building that was getting ready to get condemned. I don't know. I just would always pick the worst place to live, because I felt like that's what I deserve. And so I'm living in this building, and I had started writing in a journal, because I had this therapist had sent me to another type of meeting, 12-step meeting, not for us or anybody like us. And those people were like, oh my God, we don't know what you are, but you do not belong here. But what I got out of that was the benefit of writing in a journal for me, because some people don't like to write. But for me, I actually get something out of it. So I was writing in my journal this prayer, and I was like, God, you know, please help me. You know, and that's how desperate I was, because I really was pissed off at God and hated God. But at the same time, it was like, you know, in the off chance that you might just be having a day where you don't want to fuck with me, can you help me out just a little bit? And you know, and I want something different. And it was like, I don't know how to explain it. This weird thing came over me, and I dropped the pen, and it wasn't like I heard voices or anything like that. But I had the thought in my head that I needed to leave my apartment immediately. And I started putting my shoes on. I was like, don't put your shoes on. So I left my apartment. I walked down the street, and I'm walking pretty fast, because this is like a really weird thing happening for me. It's a spring, pre-spring day, and I end up passing by this parking garage, and I hear this weird sound coming out of it. And it was a deep, 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 deep hole in the ground where this parking garage, real dark, you couldn't see in there. And I hear this bizarre music, and I'm like, what the hell? And I walk in there, and there's this guy. And he's sitting there in the very back of the parking garage, and he was the very guy that I had seen a year before who I thought looked like Satan. And because he'd been using back then. And there he was, sitting there with the ear clean, which I didn't know at the time, but he seemed really peaceful, and he's playing these bamboo flutes. So we get to talking, and pretty much, he took me to my first meeting. I told him I thought I had a little alcohol problem. That's how I put it. I might have a little alcohol problem. You know, but he'd seen me down there. He knew who I was and what I was. In fact, when I had like 3 years clean, he informed me that I had been to an NA meeting with these people that I used to fight and roll around the floor with, that I didn't even know where the hell I was. I didn't even know I was in an NA meeting. I thought I was in some other kind of thing, and I didn't even realize that until I had 3 years clean. So, you know, half of my addiction is just a big blur. I don't remember half of the places I was or who I was with, as most of you can identify with. So anyway, he took me to my first meeting, and I remember nothing that was said except that there were these girls sitting on the back row, and they were laughing. And I thought they were laughing at me. Because, you know, it was all about me. And I remember being really upset about that, really upset. And I also remember not being able to remember what was said, but at the same time knowing without a doubt that I was a fucking addict. And I was pissed. It was raining. There was on the glass of the truck, and I remember just looking at the raindrops hitting the window of the truck going, Jesus Christ, I'm a fucking addict. This is what's wrong with me, you know? And it sucked. It sucked because I didn't want to have to go to meetings. I was terrified of people, you know? I was not into letting anybody close to me. And so, anyway, he and I hooked up, and we did the whirlwind thing that everyone suggests that you don't do. And we moved in together, and it wasn't too insane. I mean, it was pretty insane, but, I mean, he had a year clean. He'd had 4 years, and then he had relapsed. And when I first saw him, he was in relapse, and he was real scary looking. And that's saying a lot, because not a lot scared me back then. And anyway, we moved in together, and he had to go out of town a lot during the week for this job, and he's home on the weekends. So I'd go to a couple of meetings, and he'd say, well, what'd they say? What'd you get out of it? I don't know. I don't know what they talked about. I couldn't remember shit. I couldn't understand anything. But I just, you know, I didn't know what else to do with myself. So I just would go to meetings, and I had a job, and it was a really cool job. And I mean, that's got to be the universe taking care of me, because I got to transfer over to this school for these kids with, you know, different kinds of disabilities. And the love in that place was unreal. And those people loved me and accepted me. I had no social skills. I don't know what the hell. I mean, they let me work there, and they were, you know, I'd just sit there and not know what to say, and they were okay with it. But I could identify with the kids because I know what it feels like to not have a lot of freedom. And I know what it feels like to be different. So anyway, things progressed, and of course a year later we got married, and I had stopped going to meetings because I couldn't stand you guys hugging me, especially the men. You know, you guys really need to be careful with some of these newcomer women, because, I mean, you think, I don't know what you think you're getting into, but we are hell on wheels, man. We are hell on wheels. I mean, if any of you guys had ever pinched my ass, I would have fucking... Oh, you would have died. You would have died. And, you know, you just got to be careful. You never know what kind of issues somebody's bringing with them. And of course, you know, my husband is pretty tough. He survived. And, yeah, there's still time, right? And that's only half funny. It's like, oh, poor guy. But, we moved to a different town. We decided, you know, we got married, and I had been looking at these library books about New Mexico and seeing these adobe houses, and I was like real unhappy, right? Because I wasn't working a program. I mean, I was reading all this NA literature. My first sponsor was my husband, and you know how well that works. And he was also my higher power. So it was like, Todd, take my will and my life. Guide me in my recovery. You know, so I was like the blind leading the blind. I mean... God, and so we moved to New Mexico because we want to see these adobe houses, right? We get out there, it's nothing like the library book, and the job paid for it, man. We moved all, we got married the next day, you know, we don't do anything simply, we don't take those kind of suggestions, you know, we're going to get married, the next day we're going to load up the U-Haul, the next day we're moving thousands of miles away from any kind of support. You know, we got no relationship skills. And, I mean, we fought the entire way. We're driving across the country in this U-Haul. And I thought, my God, if we make it in the U-Haul, we'll survive this marriage. Because if we can survive this, we can survive anything. And so, anyway, I realized, you know, it's one of those times where, you know, the grace period is over. And I knew that if I didn't start working a program somehow and doing something different, I was going to pick up. Because I was starting to just want to use bad, real bad. So we started going to meetings, and this was in Santa Fe, and it was a small area. And it wasn't in, the meetings there were different. There wasn't a huge gang of bikers that if you said something wrong would get up and walk out of the fucking room cursing under their breath. So, you know, because I hadn't picked up any chips my first year except for my 1 year chip. I didn't pick up any chips. I would just show up, and I was scared to open my mouth because these people would get up and walk out of the room, you know, and I just was so unable to grasp that I wasn't different. I could not get that. I mean, like right now, I'm basically talking to a mirror. I mean, there is nothing that I have felt or done that if you guys, I mean, you guys can, you've either felt it, and if you haven't done it, you've done something like it. And if you don't think you have, let's talk after the meeting, because I could probably find something. I mean, there is just no uniqueness there, and that's the beautiful thing about this fellowship. But when I first got clean, I mean, I was so terminally unique. I was so unique. And my husband would tell me, you're not unique, you're not unique. And I'd be like, fuck you. Maybe you're not, you know. In my head, I'd be like, maybe you're not, you know. But these people are not like me. And I couldn't get that you guys could love me. So I started going to meetings, and I would just freak out. After the meeting, like my first 2 years clean, I'd go to meetings, and then afterwards, I'd periodically just freak out and cry all the way home. And, God, it was just hell. And I was trying to get another sponsor, and I decided to pick the meanest, toughest woman I could find, because back then, I associated kindness with weakness. So, and plus I thought, you know, I need somebody that's been around for a long time because I'm pretty crazy and I need somebody that can take it. Well, this woman, oh my God, she had been clean for so long, and I couldn't understand anything she said. But I did get that, a couple of things. I did not have any social skills, and she let me know, you don't have any social skills. You don't have any recovery. I got that. And, and you don't know how to write a four-step. I got that. And then I couldn't understand anything else she said. So then I switched, and it was like three bears. And the next woman I picked was too soft. And, you know, she was just perfect the way she was. But for where I was at, I had that opinion in my head that she was too soft. And I thought, oh, she's just so nice. God, what the hell's wrong with her? And and I know people have that, you know, I know that I come across as being real sweet and everything, and I am a very kind person a lot of the time, and I can also be a complete asshole. But at the time, I mean, I just wasn't secure with the parts of me that were real tender and vulnerable, and she was, so I pushed her away. I was like, you are not, I don't know what you are, but if this is recovery, I don't want it. And so then I found somebody that was just right. It was in between, you know, who could be real, you know, real firm and unyielding about a lot of things, but who was also very loving, very patient. And she, and it was interesting. I was always fascinated by how she could identify with so much of my stuff because she had shot dope. And that, you know, I had never shot dope. So I was like, how does she know what that feels like? I mean, how does she know that I'm, you know, thinking about doing this? Because she, I mean, it was like she was psychic. And because I thought I was unique, you know. So anyway, she taught me a whole lot about sponsorship and about, I mean, a lot of how I sponsor people and have sponsored people was just basically passing on what I got, which is that sponsorship is just about working the steps. And the first person I sponsored, I tried to be her... I was just so afraid of being rejected, and I so wanted this person to get it from me, you know. My ego was all wrapped up in it, and I tried to be her her social services, her taxi, her therapist, her, you know, grocer. I mean, I tried to just be her everything, and it didn't work. And what she was literally dying to hear was the steps, and so she relapsed, and she moved to Albuquerque, and then later on, I had a sponsor from Albuquerque who told me that she was sponsoring this girl and that she'd been clean for several years, and it was the steps that kept her clean. And I was just a part of her process, you know, and I think God puts people together. And, you know, and so for whatever reason, she needed to experience somebody trying to be her taxi and her social services and all that kind of crap. But today I don't do that. I don't take responsibility for anybody's recovery but mine. You know, if I'm sponsoring somebody, you know, it's like you can do whatever you want. If you're willing to live with the consequences, you know, you can do it. I might point out, hey, it looks to me like A, B, and C might happen as a direct result of X, Y, and Z. But, you know, it's your choice. I'm not going to live your life for you. And because I've always been hard-headed like that, and me and my husband both are, which makes it interesting. we're both real stubborn and hard-headed, and but it's about the steps, and that's really what has saved my life and just basically changed who I am. I mean, I feel like almost like on a cellular level, I am not the person that I was when I came in these rooms. And I mean, sometimes it just blows me away. Like last night, I was standing there and I was thinking, you know, St. Patrick's Day, I'll be coming up on 15 years clean, and if I do what I've been doing so far, and how the hell did this happen? You know, how did this happen? I remember being at 2 years clean thinking, okay, my sponsor has, you know, or she had 4 years clean when I met her. I remember thinking, when I get to 4 years clean, I'll be done. Because everybody just looks so together at 4 years clean, you know? Everybody looks so shiny and perfect. And so what happened was I got to 4 years clean and I was still nuttier than a fruitcake. And it was like, okay, well, maybe I need to do this for a little bit longer. And then somewhere in there, I just forgot. I forgot about clean time and really got involved in service and step work. And the next thing I know, I'm sitting here and I've been clean for quite a while. And I have a lot of friends that I really care about and that care about me. And I have a family, which is a trip. And when I had 4 years clean, I used to have panic attacks at conventions up until I had about 10 years clean, as a matter of fact. But I didn't know that's what they were. Because, you know, I have a lot of pride, and I just never think things apply to me. And I'd heard about them, but I didn't. It just never dawned on me that that could be what was happening. I just thought, I just freak out. And somebody pointed out to me at a convention, I had shared about it. She came up to me afterwards, and she was real ginger about it, like, don't bite my head off, but it sounds like you might be having panic attacks. And I kept going to conventions. People would say, well, just don't go to conventions. But, you know, I'm real stubborn, and as soon as somebody suggests to me to back down, well, that means that means I should do more of it. And so, you know, I just am so stubborn. It's like, you know, I'm just going to keep going. I'm going to keep going. And in that instance, I mean, it actually worked. I went to a convention at 10 years clean, and it was the biggest shock. I didn't have a panic attack. I felt connected. I felt loved. I felt just in total grace the entire convention, and I haven't been to one since that I have felt the stuff that I was feeling. And that's where, to me, it's always important to trust the process. And if there's something going on that I think, oh, this will never change, you know, just to have the attitude that, okay, it might and it might not. And that's real different from saying never. And that leaves room for divine intervention. And it leaves room for other addicts to get in there and teach me, because you guys teach me stuff all the time. And at 4 years clean, things changed for me. And I had gone to this convention, and it was my birthday, my NA birthday, because there wasn't a lot of people out there. You know, they have one convention that rotates through several states. They don't have a convention every year in all these different areas, because there's just not that many people. And my husband surprised me by giving me my chip. I think it was like the Saturday night speaker or something, and he surprised me, and I didn't know he was going to give it to me. And I was shaking so bad I could hardly get up to the front of the room, and I was just like just so freaked out of my gourd. It was just like there was so much love. I mean, there was so much love in that room, and people were clapping, and it literally went in my brain and just shorted out all my circuits, and I started crying. And they were like, how'd you do it? And I think I said, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what I said. I think I said grace, or I don't know, or something. I mean, and that literally, when they said don't quit before the miracle, I mean, I've had a lot of miracles. And I mean, if anybody had told me ever in my life that I would be able to feel that much love, I mean, I just wouldn't have believed it. And really, that changed recovery for me, because then I started realizing that you guys are me, and that I am you, and that there is, you know, we're going to have our problems, we're going to have our arguments and disagreements and controversy and all the petty bullshit that goes on, and we all know what it is, you know, but there's also a whole lot of love, and there's those ties that bind, and I mean, it just, my whole world shifted, and then this guy moved to our area, and he was like, you know, like that, like right after that, he was like, you guys don't have H&I? And I remember going, what's H&I? We didn't have H&I. There just wasn't a lot of people. And no one knew about H&I, and no one was doing it. And he started it, and so I got involved in that. And it was just momentum and recovery is so important. I mean, that's part of the reason why I wanted to say yes and speak, because momentum is precious, man. I mean, when you have a breakthrough, it's important to go with it and not put the brakes on, because it can lead to, you know, I mean, it's a process, and it's 3 steps forward and 2 steps back a lot of the time. But for me, you know, I don't ever want to stop going to meetings for a year and then show back up, because I'll totally trash my momentum. And I'll forget stuff because I have a built-in forgetter. And, you know, I mean, it's one thing to know just for today. But when you know it in your heart and you're actively staying in today for like a number of days in a row, I mean, it's possible to lose that. It is real easy. It's just like going to the gym. You go to the gym and next thing you know, a year's gone by and you can lift all these weights. Well, if you don't go for a year and you go back to the gym lifting those weights, A, it's impossible, and B, lifting just the baby weights is a hell of a job, you know, and it's the same thing for me with recovery. And that's what I've experienced because I started getting a lot of momentum, and doing a lot of meetings and doing a lot of step work, and people started asking me to sponsor them, and I needed that momentum, because what happened was, at 7 years clean, I think it was 7 years clean, yeah, our business and everything just fell apart, and our relationship was really starting to get rocky, me and my husband's, and he wasn't sure if he loved me anymore, and at the time, I was really sick physically, and I didn't know it. And he had sleep apnea, and he didn't know it. So we had stopped sleeping in the same room because, God, the man could snore. And he's already given me permission to say whatever the hell I want. So he probably won't do that again. But so the shit started hitting the fan, basically. And I remember going to a convention, and this woman talking about how sometimes things have to fall apart before they can fall together. And, you know, I remember being really uncomfortable with how much I could identify with that, you know, because it was like things were falling apart. And I had no idea how much more they were going to fall apart. You know, I just kind of like starting to get an inkling of it. And to make a long story a little shorter, we basically had to go through bankruptcy, which was traumatic. Oh, my God, that was so hard. And I wanted to use. I really just... I mean, it just, our arguments, and we just couldn't communicate. We just couldn't communicate. We were so at odds with each other. And where I go with that, I go to fuck you. And then, I'm sorry if there's any kids in here. And that turns to, when she gets older, I don't know what I'm going to do. Cause I cannot stop talking like this. That's just, I'm going to have to, but, oh, God, just for today. Well, anyway, fuck you turns into fuck me. And I go from fuck you, I could just kill you right now, to fuck me, I want to kill myself. And I remember, it was kind of funny, because I knew I couldn't use, and I loaded up this backpack full of Snickers bars. This is so... it's so embarrassing. But at the time, you know, I was so dead serious, but I am going to fuck myself up. I hadn't binged and purged since like 2 years before I got clean, or three maybe, because I was just so sick of it. And 3 years before I got clean, I had this spiritual experience. I'm a drug addict. I'm standing there in front of the refrigerator with my hand on the door going, oh, God, I can't do this anymore. You better fucking help me or I'm checking out. And I was serious. And it was like my hand just went limp. And I couldn't move my arm, and it was literally just hanging at my side. And I never binged and purged after that, and I haven't since. And, I mean, that's the truth. That's what happened. So anyway, here I am thinking, well, I don't want to relapse on drugs, but I can do this. And I loaded up my backpack full of Snickers bars, and I'm going to go up on top of this mesa and eat all these damn Snickers bars and then throw them up, you know, I load up Snickers bars, and I put them in the car, and then I think I just stood there at my car going, oh, my God, what the hell am I doing? You know, and thank God for sponsors, you know. And, you know, I was able to talk about that and not act out on it. And I had a couple of close calls where I came close to relapsing, but But somehow in the end, I just always dragged my ass to a meeting and just bawled my eyes out. And I remember being held for an hour. Somebody just pulled me over into their lap and held me for the whole hour. And I just cried. I just cried for an hour. And people loved me. And to be that vulnerable in a meeting, it's extremely painful. I don't like crying in front of people. But it was extremely powerful. Because when we let ourselves be vulnerable, that's where we get to find out, you know, just how lovable we really are. Because then we can experience people loving us. And it's hard. It's hard. I mean, being an addict, I mean, basically, you know, addiction is all about not being vulnerable, you know. So anyway, he said he didn't know if he loved me. And he dropped me off at the airport. We were going through bankruptcy. And I flew out here. Because I wanted to see if there was some place in North Carolina where we could live. And we decided we needed geographic change. And my grandparents were dying. And they live, well, not dying. They've been dying. They had been dying for so long. But but I wanted to be closer to them. And they live 90 miles from here, as a matter of fact. And so I came with my mom, and we checked out Asheville. And I was like, yeah, we can live here. And, you know, I went to some meetings, and I met a couple of people. I liked what I saw, and I went back, and I told Todd, yeah, let's move to Asheville, and then we'll just try to work our shit out. So we did. We loaded up the U-Haul, and we had this giant wolf dog who, oh, God. What a trip. We move out here with one vehicle and a U-Haul. We got no jobs. We got no connections. We got no place to stay. And we got no family living in Asheville. And we move here, and we just pull up to a hotel, and we're looking for a place to live, and we're driving in this fucking, I don't know, what is that? What was that thing? A Willie's Jeep. 63. As old as we were. And, I mean, the thing dies. We're looking for a house, and the thing just dies. It's sitting there in the hotel parking lot. We don't have a... I mean, I remember we were leaving a meeting and an addict just happened to be behind us and gave us a ride. And we're stuck. We got no vehicle. We're driving around the U-Haul looking for a place to live. And you know, we didn't use. We didn't use. We may have felt like it, but and we didn't kill each other. And I'm sure we felt like that. And, you know, somehow, by grace, we found a place to live and we found some work. And... And we worked out the vehicle situation, and we just got help. We just, you know, tried to get a little bit of help and work things out. And I guess it was somewhere in there, about 8 years clean, we decided to separate because things were just really rocky. And what I found out while we were separated was a couple of things. One, I found out that I had been sick probably my entire recovery with a thyroid problem. And if you don't know what that is, it's a butterfly-shaped gland right in your neck. And it, like, affects every cell in your body. And I didn't know that. I had no sex drive. That was part of our problem right there. And because he didn't know that I had a problem, you know. I mean, he just thought I didn't love him anymore. When we moved here, I was wearing long underwear in July and coats and just freezing my ass off. And I just thought that was just the way I was, you know. Things don't apply to me. You know, my mom had suggested that I get my thyroid checked, and I was just, you know, things just don't apply to me. So anyway, eventually I was getting a pap smear, and I said, you know, my mom's going to just bitch me out if I don't ask you to just check my thyroid. I know it's stupid, blah, blah. And then they call me up, and they say, you're going to die. You need to come get this medication today. I don't understand how you're not in a coma. And, you know, my brain was shutting down. Like, I was unable to drive. I could hardly drive a car. I couldn't find the exit. I couldn't talk. I couldn't think. And I was really, really depressed. And, of course, depression, that can't apply to me. But I knew that I was, because as soon as I started taking the medication, the depression started, you know, to lift a little bit. And it took 3 years to get it regulated. You know, and I can't believe how sick I was and how in denial of that I was, because it was like I'd wake up every morning, it was like somebody had beat me with a baseball bat every night, you know, and we can stay clean through that stuff. And I was an emotional basket case, too, and people didn't judge me, and they loved me and accepted me for who I was, and So I stayed clean through that, and we were separated for a couple months, and I really thought we were going to get divorced. And then I was stalking my husband a little bit. I would drive by his house, you know, at all hours just to see if anybody was over there, you know, because he couldn't have left me because of me. You know, there had to be somebody else, right? And it was just a real crazy time, a real painful time. You know, lots of tears. And thank God for you guys and for meetings and step work and all that stuff. And I was looking at a lot of sixth and seventh stuff through that, and looking at my self-centeredness. And that's always really been kind of hard. It's real painful. And self-centeredness isn't just me. A lot of it's, I mean, self-centered fear. Like I have a fear of talking in front of people, and that self-centered fear just kicks my ass. And as soon as I can, you know, apply, you know, the principle opposite of that and remember that it's just about carrying the message and being of service, then I can have some freedom from that. And in our relationship, you know, I've had to work on that a lot. And he has too, and we're both extremely self-centered. We never wanted to have a kid, ever. Neither one of us, because we were just so, we were like, we're too self-centered. We can barely tolerate each other. You know, I mean, having a dog was a stretch. I mean, it was huge. So anyway, we lived apart for a year and dated, and that was really, really good for our relationship. And it was really good for him and for me to understand that I had been really sick. And he started dealing with his sleep apnea because he was falling asleep at stoplights and stuff. And so that, you know, and that causes depression. And so he was whacked because of that. And so we started dealing with our health and working things out. And, you know, it's just been an interesting journey. And I don't know where something changed. I mean, when I was 38, it was kind of, I had the thought in my brain that I might someday want to have a child, but I decided to go and get a tattoo on my neck instead. you know, but that thought was kind of in there. You know, I would have these maternal urges. I'd see other babies and I'd be like, what is this? What the hell is this? And then when I turned 39, I mean, it just slammed me, because I'm an artist, and a big part of my spirituality is painting. You know, I start painting, and I see images in my head, and I don't know where they come from, and I just assume that it's from some aspect of my higher power, and I just paint it. And when I'm painting, I'm in the moment, and time stops. And up to that point, that had been enough for me, and I started to feel like the script was changing a little bit. And suddenly that wasn't enough for me. And I talked to my husband about it, and I was trying to just check in with him. I really didn't expect him to be feeling the same way, and it turned out that he was feeling the same way. So we tried for a couple of months, and then at the time, I, you know, 3 months, and to me, that's a long time. And, so I'm like hysterical. Oh, I must not be fertile, you know. And we just need to adopt, and, you know. And it was only 3 months, but we got pregnant. As soon as I went there, it was like, let go, and then it happens. And, well, I got pregnant. There was no we to it. And I had lots of complications, lots of problems. My thyroid went nuts. And you know, and I went from a year and 9 months ago being this person that could, you know, I could sponsor like 7 people in recovery. I could go to lots of meetings. I write in my journal. I do walking meditation every day. Paint whenever I want. And then it was like, as the pregnancy progressed, things just started falling away because my health was kind of, you know, kind of iffy, and I stopped having the ability to show up. And so I had to let go of my sponsees, and that was really, really painful and difficult and good, because I believe that, you know, it's important for people to have a sponsor that can show up for them. So anyway, to make a long story shorter, I had a lot of complications at the end, and I had to go like every 2 weeks for stress tests. It's called a non-stress test, which is a joke, because basically it means you got to sit in this chair, we're going to listen to your belly, and if it doesn't sound right, we're going to whisk you away and take that baby out of you. You know, so I'm sitting there all stressed out, and And this baby never stopped moving in my stomach. I mean, she never stopped moving, ever. I mean, they'd be like, oh, my God, we're doing a kick count. Look at all these kicks. You know, I mean, she just was going wild in there, and she's like that now. And she gets that from her daddy. And I think the universe said, you know, you're not getting these lessons deep enough with your husband. We're just going to give you one more, you know. But anyway, the pregnancy was kind of traumatic. You know, I had shared this before, and I don't want to freak anybody out, but there's this thing called birth ecstasy where you just, like, hang out and you're just relaxed and you don't have any pain, and then the baby pops out and you have an orgasm and the baby's born, and you know, and I really, in the back of my mind, I get these fantasies, and they're not close enough to the front where I share them with anybody because, you know, that'll ruin it. So I hold them in the back of my head, right? So I got this fantasy that's what it's going to be like. And I get, you know, I don't know what made me think that. Here I am, 40, you know, almost 41. I've got thyroid problems. I've got gestational diabetes. My blood pressure's starting to fuck up. The kid's like, you know, moving like crazy, and they got me on this diet because they were afraid she was going to get absolutely huge, and I was huge, and people kept asking me if I was going to have twins, and here I am thinking I'm going to have birth ecstasy, you know? I mean, I did not have birth and hips. I mean, what? So anyway, from the time that I stopped being able to sleep through contractions to the time she was born, it was 32 hours. And I'm like hard-headed, and I've like decided ahead of time that I'm not going to do painkillers. I'm not going to have any pain medication. And so I didn't, because by the time I decided I fucking did want it, it was too late. And it was the most beautiful experience of my life. And it was a little bit like The Exorcist. There was fluid coming out of all ends. There was screaming. There was yelling. Then I had to lay flat on the table because they had to hook me up to all this crap because it wasn't progressing. And then there was a lip that was stuck. And then she got stuck. And all this drama. And so finally they're like, oh my God, she's stuck. You know, and I flip over and rah, the mother bear energy comes and she comes flying out, and I'm like, oh, thank God, you know, and I'm just like euphoric, right? Just euphoric, man. It's over, she's okay, and I'm laying there, and they bring her, you know, over to me, and they're like, you know, the placenta's not coming out, and I'm like, well, so fucking what? Who gives a shit, you know? I mean, at that point, a little placenta, just leave it up there. You know? We don't care. And the guy's like, oh, my God. They get the midwife goes, and they get the doctor over, and he's like, I'm going to have to manually remove it. And I'm like, fine. You know, your little old tiny surgeon arm up there is nothing. And the midwife goes, you don't understand. You want drugs for this. And I said, no, I don't. Yes, you do. You have to. So, fine. You know, and they shoot me up with something. I won't tell you what it was. But it really messed with me for months. And the euphoria that I felt was no longer, it was different. It was that I am high as a kite euphoria. And it was just so pissy to go through 32 freaking hours of agony and then get a damn shot. I mean, it really pissed me off. You know? But the baby was fine. So he's yanking and tugging and pulling. And then he's like, oh, my God, it's not coming out. We have to go do surgery. You're hemorrhaging. And we could have to do a hysterectomy and all this drama. And my poor husband, I mean, it was really traumatic for him, way more than me. Because, like I said, I was high as a kite. I was like, go ahead, it'll be fine. I'll be fine. The baby's fine. And so anyway, they did surgery, and I lost 50% of my blood, and I almost died. And I woke up, and I was in the whatever, intensive care, and the surgeons and the doc and the blood specialist and the OR nurse and everybody kept coming up to my room thanking me for living, and every time they do that, it was like, oh my God, please don't tell me that, you know. And what happened was, you know, I ended up going through months and months of being pissed off at my higher power for even allowing me to come close to dying when I have this baby to take care of. And I copped a huge resentment. On top of obsessing off and on about the stuff that they shot me up with. And it was really hard. And I had postpartum depression, and it was suggested to me to just try and reach out more to the women, that's normal. You can just basically work a better program and get over it. And I tried. And at times it did make a difference, but I'll tell you, by the time November came around, I kind of get blue in the winter anyway, and I noticed I was having a really hard time getting out of bed. And thank God for my home group, because that's the one meeting I would go to no matter what. I mean, you know, if my leg is chopped off, I'm showing up at my home group meeting. I mean, unless I have the flu. I mean, I don't want to love y'all that much. I'm going to show up. And that really saved me, because it was just hard. And November came, and I started having a hard time getting out of bed. And, you know, things don't apply to me. So I'm like, it's not postpartum depression, and I don't get depressed. I mean, you know, blah, blah. And my husband and different people were pointing out to me that, you know, I didn't see myself. I seemed depressed. And you know, he was really supportive of me trying to look for a solution for it. And we go to the baby's doctor appointment a couple of weeks ago, and he narcs on me. I mean, that's what it's like being married to an addict, man. He basically just, like, he just narked on me. And the guy said, yeah, you probably need to take something for that. And at that point, you know, I just surrendered. And I used to have a really heavy judgmental attitude towards antidepressants. And then that softened a little bit, because I sponsored some people that really taught me a lot about how people that need medication. And that medication, if you have a need for it, isn't a drug. Just like me taking thyroid medication is not me using dope, because I have a need for it. So, what the heck was I talking about? See how that works? She starts crying and my brain just goes, wow! So anyway, I started taking something for it a week and a half ago. And, of course, I had already said I'd tell my story. And I'm, like, thinking, I can't tell my story now. Or I can't take this. Because if I tell my story, it'll come out if I'm taking it. And I can't get up there and lie. And thank God for other addicts who talk sense into me and remind me of things. Like, you know, having a program means taking care of ourselves. And that people that mind don't matter, and people that matter don't mind. And so it's been a week and a half, and I'm feeling much better. And I'm able to wake up in the morning. I'm able to take care of her. She's very high need. I mean, this kid, she's smart. She started walking, like, she started cruising at 8 months. I mean, she came out of my womb biting the nurses. She was, like, biting their finger, like, she's just really high energy, and she's really smart. And, you know, I got to be able to think while I'm dealing with her, so that I don't do something stupid, like forget to strap up her car seat, you know? I mean, it's a huge responsibility. So I feel okay with that decision. And I'm so grateful to have stayed clean this past year. It's been a trip to not have a bunch of sponsees and to not have the freedom to go to tons of meetings. And, you know, I mean, without that kind of structure around me, you know, I really have had to really work hard. And it's possible to stay clean and get into a period of grace where you just go for years and shit just comes naturally and you just truck right along, you know. You just apply that 12-step works. You just apply principles in all your affairs, or in my case, most of them. And, and you know, you got a lot of stability, and your mind is just fairly smooth. I mean, it's possible to do that. And then for me, it was like I fell out of that because, you know, of circumstances. And, I mean, it was a good thing in a way, because I have a lot of gratitude, and it kind of has reawakened me to the idea of, I heard that. Anyway, it has kind of reawakened me the importance of just applying basics, you know, having 1, 2, and 3, and being close to my higher power and having a network of women and working with the sponsor and all that stuff, because it's not like it comes naturally. I have to think about it right now. I mean, it's going to take me a while. And having a baby is really time consuming. And I have really come to the place where, you know, I have to take care of myself. And that stuff that was important in my first night step was making amends to my body, you know, making sure I get sleep, making sure I eat right, you know, making sure that if I'm stressed out, I talk to somebody and take a hot bath, bubble bath, and, you know, just sit down and relax for a few minutes, paint my fingernails, you know, just do stuff to nurture me. And that's stuff that I haven't had to stop and think about. And now it's like, you know, days go by and hell, I haven't had a shower. You know, I forget because I'm so busy with taking care of her. And so I'm just kind of going back to some basic stuff. And our relationship, God, having a baby really takes all your resentments and issues in your relationship, and ours anyway, and, like, brings it to the next level. I mean, if you think you didn't have stuff to fight about, you know, you have a baby, you got stuff to fight about. Oh my God. I am so sorry. I thought I had to talk till 12. Well, you know, I've just been. Well, I'm really amazed. I really usually don't have that much to say. Oh my God. Well, anyway. We're doing fine. We're not divorced. We haven't killed each other. And I'm really grateful that y'all sat in here and listened to me talk for an hour and a half. I'm so embarrassed. And I love you very much. Thanks for listening. Thank you.